welcome everybody to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. Good morning. Got a special morning show lined up for you. Again, as I always say, it's a great day to be alive and have another opportunity to bring you another powerful show. All of these shows have the potential in some way, shape, or form to change your life if you're open and you're, you know, ready to receive information. Sometimes it's information that you may have heard before. Other times it's information that you may not have heard before. Well, today's special morning edition is with a regular on Health, Wealth, and Divine. For all of you entrepreneurs out there, I know you're excited because we get an opportunity again to sit at the feet of someone who's been doing, who's been an entrepreneur for over 50 years, a successful entrepreneur for over 50 years. You get the benefit of actually sitting and listening and even calling in if you've got questions or comments that you'd like to make. You may have situations going on with your own business. Here's an opportunity for you to give to call in. The call-in number is 347-324-5727. And you can ask whatever questions you may have of my special guest, Professor Geiger. Again, he's a regular on the show, comes on every other, right now he comes on every other Tuesday. And we're going through his awesome book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Again, it's Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Yeah, for some, I just heard somebody say 105. Yeah, 105. 105 business principles. What do you think? There were like five? No, there's much more than that. There are many situations that will present themselves to you, much more than 5 or 6 or 10 or 15. So we're going to tell you how you can get the book. We're actually going through the book, reviewing the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. And again, there's 105 of them. And today we're going to be exploring a few more. So let me tell you about my guest. If you're not familiar with Professor Geiger, he's currently retired. Professor grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, Professor taught entrepreneurship and small business management. In order to help people like yourself and myself succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, 101 Practical Business Principles, The Road to the Top. And the book has just been growing ever since he wrote the first edition. We're actually up to the fourth edition now because he keeps coming up with more principles and keeps sharing them with us. And so it's with great honor and pleasure that I'm able to, again, bring to you Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Again, Professor, as always, awesome to talk to you again. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You know, Professor, you are a very interesting person. I want to share this with the listeners. We've got a few shows coming up, other shows, special shows with Professor Geiger coming up. We're going to be talking about a few other things that are really going to pique your interest. I'm going to let it be a surprise until maybe a few days prior to the show I shared with you, but I just want to, you know, whet your appetite. You're going to really, really love this information that Professor and I are going to be discussing. That's all I got to say for about it right now, but get ready. Mark your calendars because on Monday, April the 1st, okay, I'm going to be doing a special show with Professor Geiger, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we approach that day. But, Professor, today we're going, again, through the book, principle by principle. Wow, and we are up to principle number 56. We're in chapter 7, everybody, starting a business. Again, we're going through the book, principle by principle, chapter by chapter. This chapter is on starting a business. Very important because up until this point, you know, the foundation was laid, but now that that has been laid and you're ready to start your business, there are certain things that you need to know. Professor, you say that, I just want to share this with the listeners, you say that some of the things that you learned were through trial and error. You didn't have this book to help you when you started out, so you know what you're talking about when you're advising people on how to start a business and other and the other different chapters in the book. But for the listeners who are just tuning in, how did you get started?
Well, I got started in high school, actually, with my first business to help me get some cash, which being a farm boy, I didn't really have, and I was dyslexic, so my parents scrimped and saved and sent me away to a college, a high school that specialized in kids with dyslexia. And when I was there, the high school was in the East in Massachusetts, and most of the students there were frankly from rather wealthy families. We had one of the Goodyear sons there, Goodyear Tire and Rubber. So they were very, very wealthy kids, and they most of them got fairly substantial allowances to go spend. But my parents really couldn't afford that, so I started a paper business there, a newspaper business, that gave me a good deal of cash. And when I sold it, it was a foundation for other endeavors after that. And then the second one was to help pay for my way through college, and that was manufacturing trout fishing flies, very tiny ones. And that really paid my way. I was in that one. I sold them in groups of three, and I could make about nine of them or so an hour. And so that gave me three packages. In today's money, I was making about $150 an hour making these little things. And so it was a big help in college. So that's kind of how I got started. You mentioned that the book had gone from 101 principles to 105. And the one we're going to talk today is one of the reasons it grew, because throughout my business career, I never could figure out any kind of an easy system to hire good people. And a business grows and thrives on good people. If you have that skill to hire good people, you're almost guaranteed to be a success in business. And if you don't have it, it's a problem. And frankly, I did not have it. And I blundered my way through, and I was was teaching when I finally found somebody who had a method that was really, really easy to put into action, and it worked. And he was a business turnaround artist. In other words, he started with businesses that were on the verge of bankruptcy and turned them around. And one of the secrets to doing that was this method that we're going to talk about today.
Well, you know, that's interesting that there's actually a method out there to help people with that. And by the way, everybody, this is there's two parts to this. There's the first part and the second part. There is a method to hiring people, again, which is principle number 56. It's going to be interesting because there are people out here that have the gift of gab. There are also people out here that are, you know, just good interviewees, okay? They're comfortable sitting in front of a stranger. They're comfortable with you asking them questions. There are also people that are good resume writers. You know, they can just write a resume that just jumps off the page at you, you know. And these are methods that people use to get hired. I mean, you know, that once their resume has been read and if it's impressive enough and they get a call to come in for an interview, you have people that can kind of breeze through that whole process but not necessarily be good employees. A lot of employees have hired people and then turned around and had to fire people, people that they thought were very impressive. You know, I mean, people who were very impressive in the interview, had very impressive resumes, I mean, you know, made the first good impression and then had to get fired. So with that, how do you determine what is the method of hiring good people? Because it can be tricky.
Yeah, it can. To kind of expand a little bit about what you were just talking about, Newt Gingrich tells the story Actually, it's from somebody else who wrote a terrific article. And it's the article is called IYI, Intellectual Yet Idiot. And the gist of it is that there's people who come out of college who are really, really good at taking tests and writing papers. And the same is true in getting hired. But what they're good at is taking tests and writing papers. They're not good at anything else. And so if you get one of these guys, he could write a wonderful paper on how to change a tire, a car tire. But if you pulled up in front of his home with a flat tire, he would have absolutely no idea how to do it. And this is true, too. So basically the problem I had is I really wasn't very good at trying to judge people there. So but I came up with found a friend who had turned around seven companies, and this is his method, and he said it works. It doesn't make any difference what kind of company you have, what its condition is. But if you want to find good people, here's how to do it. First of all, you get the applicant to fill out a standard Java application, and you bring them in. Now, the problem with the way people are usually hired, they are hired by the IT program, the IT department, and they're the ones who interview and hire. The problem with that is that the IT people don't have the foggiest notion of what it takes to hire somebody, the job, what it takes for somebody to do a particular job. Their purpose, IT's purpose, is personnel. But the person you're hiring, they may run a printing press. They may sell stuff. They may be, who knows what they're doing. They may be a janitor. The IT doesn't have any idea what it takes to be a janitor or to run a printing press. They know people. That's it. So basically what my friend did is he came up with 40 categories. And they were such things as the applicant, and you get the applicant to read through these 40 categories and check off 15 of them that they think are reflective of themselves. So here's a couple of them. They're friendly, affable, intense, trustworthy. They have skills. They're good planners. They're careful. They're handy with things. They're outgoing, curious, ethical, so on. There's 40 of these. And before the person ever comes in, you go to the various department managers whoever is in charge of a group of people, and you get them to figure out 15 of the 40 items here that they think are common with their very best workers. And my friend Jerry said that it's pretty easy to do. And then when the applicant comes in, you get them to read through the 40 and to check off 15 that they think are the most reflective of how they are, the applicant is, what kind of personality they have, their worth ethic, and so on. You check off 15. Do the 15 that the manager checked and the 15 that the applicant checked agree? If they don't agree, they probably aren't going to be a good match. If they do agree, they probably are. So if the manager is an office manager, they will have very different items that they check off compared with somebody who is in charge of running a machine shop and running, say, a printing press. They're very different. But the applicant needs to match. And this is, as you say, number 56, I guess, in my book. So if you have the problem of hiring people, go to the book, copy this down, take it around to your responsible people in your business, and get them to figure out what it is among their the people they supervise, how they match up with these 40 items. Now, you might want to add something or whatever, but this is a list that's been tested all over the country, and it works. So you get them to, if they match up, then they will probably be a good program or a good fit for the job you're looking for. It does not have, you'll notice there's nothing in here that IT does. What IT does, if you have a pretty good-sized company and you have a formal personnel department, then your personnel department checks the applicant's, whether the applicant is being truthful, whether the applicant has what the applicant's background is. They do all of that stuff, but they do not hire the person. The hiring decision is made by the supervisor under which these people will work. And this is one of the reasons that I went from 101 business principles to 105. This was one of the additions, because I could never figure out a method. The methods that people told me were involved. They involved a good deal of personal skill for the interviewer. This doesn't involve any personal skill. I mean, supervisor is going to interview this applicant, but the real decision is made on whether or not how they match up with the 15 items that they think that represents them to the 15 items that the supervisor found represented his successful employees. That's all there is to it. It's simple.
You know what's interesting too, professors, because I'm looking at the list, and I mean, so the employees asked to pick 15 of these 40 that they feel best represents them?
Right. Correct.
Okay. Now, they're all positive. You know what I mean? So, you know, they're all positive statements. They're not like, I mean, it's timely, successful, you know, trustworthy, dependable, and intense, you know, all of these. I mean, well, okay, so with the exception of maybe intense, okay, because let's say, for example, if it's a job that you're applying for a job that would not require you to be intense, you wouldn't put intense down. But, of course, everybody would put trustworthy, regardless of what the position is. Everybody would put, you know, let's see, dependable or, you know, you know, like that. So,
here's the problem, Chuanza. Pretty soon, you're right up against your 15 items. You can't check 16. You got to keep it to 15.
Right.
So you want to, you look at all these 40. You want to check all of them. Well, you can't check all of them. You can only check 15 of them. So what are the 15, and how do those 15 compare with the successful people who are doing the job?
Interesting. Well, I'm going to assume then that there have been studies done that have, you know, tried and tested this method, and those that have utilized the method have found that, you know, that it works. Because, again, you still have everybody. I mean, I would check most of them myself, you know, except for the ones that if it didn't apply, if it didn't necessarily need me to be intense or, you know, something like that. I mean, you know, so.
Well, you know, you say intense, but what if what you're doing is you're putting together a very intricate piece of equipment that takes absolute concentration to get it put together right. And if you don't tighten down a screw the proper amount, maybe it breaks off because you tighten it too tight or you strip the threads. This takes intensity. I mean, you really have got to concentrate on something. So who have a concentration problem, who kind of wander and they don't really want to be that exacting, they're going to have a problem with that job.
you're going to have to assume that the person that's filling it out is telling the truth, because if you, again, if you're applying for a position that requires that in type of intensity for, you know, or any other qualities that are on the list, you assume that the person that's applying for the position is being honest, and that if they do not possess that trait, that they won't say that they possess that trait, because surely in time they're going to be found out anyway. You know, once they, you know,
yep.
Like you asking somebody, can they fly a plane? You know, you're going to find out soon enough whether or not the person can fly a plane. But yeah, certainly you're going to find out eventually whether or not they were being honest on the application, or, you know, when taking the test. But it's interesting. I mean, it's very interesting. So that's part one. What's the second part, Professor? You said there's two parts to this.
Well, the first part is all it is, what everybody does. When you apply for the job, you complete the standard personnel job application form. And then somebody takes that and looks at it and checks to see what you put down there is true. That's what personnel does. But that normally is kind of the beginning and the end of the interview. And, you know, they take a look at somebody. Are they neat and clean? And if they're going to be front office, are they dressed well? And do they talk well? Do they communicate well? And all of that. But I never found anything other than those kind of vague methods of hiring people that seemed to work until I met Jerry Quirk. He's a retired military. He was a colonel in the military. And as a matter of fact, if you were in the Army, there for about a year and a half, if you wanted to join the Army and there was any kind of problem or anything, he was the one who decided whether you were in or out in the entire United States Army, nationwide. He was it.
Mm-hmm.
He had 100% power. And nobody had to go to. He was it. So and then when he ran these businesses, these turnarounds, he was only there usually for 6 months, maybe a year. And he got it turned around, turned it back to the owner, and here you go. You now have a profitable business with well-oiled working people. So it works great. And he turned it back to him and go to another one. But here, you see, here's what happens. Because you can only pick 15, it limits you. And pretty soon, you know, people go through and they try to be shifty. And that's fine. You know that up before you start. They want a job and they're trying to figure out what you want. But because there's 40 of these things and you can only pick 15, pretty soon you start thinking, well, I can't pick 16. So, I checked 24 of them and now I got to uncheck 9 of them. Which 9 do I uncheck? And I don't want to uncheck any of the 9. But which 9 do I uncheck? And Jerry said it never failed. It worked. They never had a failure. And all the people he hired, once he got this down, it worked. And I'm not entirely sure I understand why it worked. Because I'm like you, I'd want to check all of them.
Exactly. Exactly.
But you
and
can't.
Even if of them, again, they're all pretty positive. So even if somebody checked 15. And they were all positive, you could really turn away. So, and let's say they were being honest. Let's say the person that was filling out the or taking the test or the questionnaire was being absolutely honest, and they were punctual, they were timely, they were all of these things, and they got to 15, but those 15 were not the other positive traits that the employer had on their list. You could potentially not hire a very good worker.
Right. Correct. Absolutely.
Interesting.
You know,
hey,
and I've had in the 11 businesses I started, and some of them were pretty good size, had well over 100 people. I have, on a couple of occasions, hired somebody because they so impressed me And I didn't really have a job for him, so I made up a job to keep him around until we could find a fit, because they were so impressive. And but this one is a job specific. So do you have somebody who is going to drive a truck? And the requirements of driving a truck are very different from the requirements of being an auditor.
Correct.
So that's the neat thing about this.
Interesting. Well, and, everybody, if you get phone calls, the board is lighting up. So just want to let everybody know, if you have a question, you'd like to talk to Professor Geiger, all you have to do is press 1 if you're listening by phone. And I can bring you on, and you can ask your question. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 347-324-5727. Again, that's 347-324-5727. We're talking about entrepreneurship. We're going through his book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Again, we're on principle number 56. Were you ready for 57, Professor?
Yeah, let me make one more comment about, you mentioned that how many principles they are. The reason there's so many is because the principles are specific to many, many circumstances. One of the problems when I wrote the book that I found in teaching entrepreneurship in college is the textbooks were vague. I mean, they when you got through reading something, you said to yourself, well, that's really good. Now, how do I put this in action? And the question is, very often when I got through asking myself that question, my answer was, beats me. I don't have a clue. I mean, it sounds good, but how do you actually put it in? I don't know how. Well, what the 105 business principles, you won't have any trouble finding and figuring out how do I put principle number 18 in action. I mean, it's very, very specific. There are a few generalities, probably about 10 of them in there that are generalities. But if you want to put up a roadside sign, it tells you very specifically how you do it. So anybody can do that and be successful at it. And if you read most roadside signs driving down the highway, you'll find that skill is pretty scarce. Because most of them, you can't even read them. I mean, there's too many words on it. You're going trying to drive and not have a wreck, and here's a sign with 25 words on it. How the heck are you going to read all that stuff? So, at any rate, that's the reason that there's 105.
Well, that's a good thing, because again, there are a lot of people that when they write are kind of vague, and you know, they don't give you the hands-on or take you by the hand and show you how to do it. And for people that are starting a business, we'll just say a first-time person starting a business for the first time, not someone who's starting their fifth or sixth business, but somebody that's starting their very first business, they need to be shown exactly, okay, how do I do that? You know, you've given me the principle, but now how do I enact that? How do I actually get that from out of my head, off the paper, from the theory into action? How do I translate that from the paper into something actionable? So 105, that's good. You've covered a lot in this book. I mean, just in terms of the different situations that can arise. So again, everybody, we're going to tell you how you can get the book during the course of this interview, and you're going to definitely need it if you are serious about being an entrepreneur. Okay, so we're moving on to then 57. Business experience trumps a college degree. Business experience trumps a college degree. Professor?
Yeah, let me give you two examples. Well, first of all, this I didn't come up with this idea. Sun Tzu, who was a Chinese general who lived 2,500 years ago and wrote a very famous book called The Art of War, which has been in print for 2,500 years. So it's far and away the oldest book ever written that has continuously been in print. The next closest is probably the Bible, And so this beats the Bible by probably 800 years. At any rate, in the Art of War, Sun Tzu says the best technical school is experience. And I'll give you a couple of examples of how that works. The experience of being successful at the business. My older brother is a chemical engineer, and I wrote another book called Finding a Career for Life, and I have to rewrite it every year because it's very specific on different degrees that are required and which ones are really doing good and which are not. What kind of jobs, whether they require a degree or not, which are doing really well and paying well and which aren't. And Oliver has a degree in chemical engineering. The average as of today, and he's been retired for 15 years. So when he was working, the average pay scale was much lower, but today it's about $122,000 a year, so it pays pretty well. 25 years ago, Oliver was making well over twice that. He had a degree in chemical engineering, and then a second degree in construction management, construction engineering. And so what he did is he built chemical plants. Primarily for the oil and gas industry, Exxon. He worked for Exxon for his last 18 or 19 years. And he was paid well over twice what the average is today. Back then, probably the average was $70,000, $80,000, and Ali made three times that. And how'd he do it? Well, first, he had great experience. He was a extraordinarily hard worker. I mean, he was just really. And he said the way he did it was he built the chemical plants and he finished them ahead of time and under budget. And how do you do that? And he said he always did it. Every single one of his that he was in charge of was well ahead of time and well under budget. And he said it's simple. When construction starts, you're there 10 to 12 hours a day. You're there every day that they're actually building, so certainly 5 days a week, very often 7 days a week. And you solve the problems before they become problems because you know what they're doing so well. And he said because of that, he was given jobs to do all over the world. And they paid increasingly more because these were multi-million dollar. Well, one of the last ones he built was over $1 billion to build a chemical plant in Saudi Arabia, and he was in charge of it. And he started out in charge of a third of that. He got that done a year ahead of time. And before he finished that, he was so far ahead, they turned over another portion to him that was behind schedule. He pulled that up until it was done ahead of time. And then the third guy was almost a year behind, and he pulled that one up and got it where the whole job was done on time. And although his area was way under budget, the second area was a little under budget, and the third one was over budget. But he said, heck, it was already over budget when he took it over. And but the whole project ended up slightly under budget. And he was paid over $250,000 a year. They paid all of his living expenses. So it was essentially, and taxes, so it was essentially $250,000 after taxes. And this was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so he had great experience. So, and that's how he did it. And I think that is true. You're hearing now a whole lot of negative talk about getting a college degree. It used to be 30 years ago that the word was that if you didn't have a college degree, there was no way to get a good job. Well, that has been, that's just patently not true. For people who are really good at what they do, there is always a way to get a good job. And I had a high school friend, I relate the story in the book, when he graduated from high school, he was a farm boy, and his dad said, well, you're 18 now, son, go get a job, because you're not living here for free. And he ended up getting a job as a trash collector for a small town. And he said it was a terrible job, but it was better than no job at all. So he then, shortly thereafter, he took over the trash collection because he found out that the city hated having to do it. So he went in and volunteered. He said, I'll do it. And he gave them a price, and they said, you bet, you're on. And by the time I graduated from college, he had a terrific recycling business. And needless to say, no debt, and a tremendous business. And think of what they did. He got paid for picking up trash. And he said, you wouldn't believe the stuff people threw away. Perfectly good stuff. I mean, some of it was like bottles that you could sell back. And he said, I picked up bathtubs, all kinds of stuff. And at that time, this was 60-plus years ago, and at that time, there was no such thing as recycling. Well, he started it by finding markets for this stuff. And so the people paid him to pick up stuff. They gave it to him to start with. They paid him to haul it away. He sorted out the good stuff, whether it was just paper that he could sell as scrap paper or bottles or whatever it was, and he resold that. And that's all pure profit. He already made a profit by just hauling it away. And his return was like 25% profit. Wow. After, you know, after all expenses. Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So there's experience is where it's really at.
Well, speaking of that, let me ask you this then. What do you think about, what are your thoughts on the job training? Because I'm sure, I mean, I've heard this coming up myself, just growing up, you hear this at some point when you're younger, you know, you and your friends are out looking for a job, whether it's your first job, second, third, fourth, fifth job or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And they're looking for people with experience. And oftentimes the person with no experience says, well, how am I supposed to get the experience if nobody would give me a first chance to even to train me or whatever? What are your thoughts on the job training? I know it would probably depend on the job, but your thoughts on the job training. Do you think that most employers should either have a section or a division devoted to training people with no experience to help them to get that?
Well, what the inference of that question is that they should hire people who can't do anything and pay them to really screw things up. And the answer to that is that what you have to do is start looking for a helper's job. And let's say that you want to go into medicine, but you don't have the money to spend 10 years in college getting an MD. Well, you could always be a nurse, but you're not a nurse now. How the hell do you get a nurse's job when you're not a nurse? They can't hire you for that, but they can't hire you as a nurse's aide. So maybe what you do is you get a job as a nurse's aide that doesn't pay very much at all, but you get the job at a teaching hospital. And there's lots of teaching hospitals where they hold classes where you can become like a registered nurse. And you start out as without that. So what you do is you get a job as a nurse's aide, which all that requires is the ability to empty bedpans and tuck sheets. And that's about it. But that's the kind of job you get. And it doesn't pay very much. But you immediately register to go to classes to become a registered nurse. And that might take a year or two. But in the meantime, you're learning, and in the meantime, they're going to, as you get more and more credits, they're going to give you more and more responsibility. That's kind of a training job. In the building trades, it's been the way of life for 1,000 years that people started out in the building trades carrying bricks. And then they became an assistant bricklayer. And then they became a mason, a journeyman bricklayer. And today, all of those kind of jobs, whether they be electrician or a plumber or whatever, it's not at all difficult to get that kind of a job once you are certified to get that kind of job that pays $70,000-$80,000 a year. So, but it doesn't start that way. You start let's say you're a builder. You start carrying lumber and loading trucks and carrying bags of nails, and it doesn't pay very well. But you learn by as you go. So there's not every job, every career does not necessarily have that. But a surprising number of them do. And nowadays in college, getting a summer job, which may not pay hardly at all. I mean, some do, but many of them don't. If you don't have that, it's difficult to get hired. When I graduated from college in 1960, the companies would tell you, well, you have a job in liberal arts or you have a degree in liberal arts. We don't have anything to put you to work, but we will train you. And but that doesn't exist much anymore. So
I was thinking about apprenticeship programs, you know, where they actually hire apprentices to, you know, they're not going to let them do the, you know, the serious stuff here, but they're learning. I mean, they're in training to one day become certified, whatever the position is. You know, just to give people an opportunity. But even with that, you would have to, I'm sure, if things are still the same, you still have to show some aptitude for whatever the apprenticeship is. You know, you still have to show, you probably have to pass a test just to be admitted into the apprenticeship program.
Yeah, I think you do. And having hired lots and lots of people, I can tell you just coming on time and being attentive to the job and not using drugs, so on, is trying to find people who fit that profile isn't frankly all that easy. I mean, I've fired a bunch of really really good workers because they insisted on using drugs, and I was either in the airplane business or building yachts, and we just could not tolerate that. I mean, you can't have somebody that is a mechanic working on airplanes who is strung out on pot or on whatever. And I don't care whether you don't think that if you're one of those people who thinks that, well, pot doesn't harm you at all and you can do a good job, that may be, and you may be doing a great job, but I can tell you for sure that if you were a mechanic working on an airplane and something went wrong, and it's not your fault what went wrong, but the attorneys find out that you're on drugs, oh, my God. I mean, the employer is, oh, Jesus. Even if they're willing to admit what you were doing had nothing to do with the accident, the employer is in a terrible shape.
Or would you get in a plane with a pilot if you knew the pilot was high?
well, no, of course not. But frankly, there's very little way to know whether the pilot's high.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a two-pilot airplane, take this last crash of the Boeing 737 MAX. I don't know whether it was an 8 or a 9. The co-pilot supposedly had just over 200 hours total flying time. Now, he's a co-pilot, so he's not flying the airplane. Maybe. But maybe he is.
Hopefully.
Because the way airlines work, where there are two pilots, one pilot flies the first leg of the journey, and the second one, the co-pilot, flies the second, or vice versa. So you don't know who was actually flying the airplane. Is it that guy with 200 hours? I've got 9,000 hours of flying. And near the end of my career, I didn't even keep track. I had so many. I didn't care. I mean, I may have way over 9,000, but I had 9,000 hours registered in logbooks. Would I be qualified to fly a 747 with a 737 with a quickie checkout? Not no, sir, but hell no. Not even close. And yet there was the co-pilot had 200 hours. How many hours did the full-time pilot have, the pilot, the captain? I don't know.
Good question.
But it wouldn't surprise me if he didn't have 1,000 hours. And trying to get a airline job with 1,000 hours in this country is a bit of a challenge, frankly.
Which one are you talking about, Professor? Because there's been a few, and one I saw it crashed not long after takeoff. I don't even know how far
both
it got off.
Both of them were
the
right after takeoff. Both were right after takeoff. Of the 737 MAX 8s or 9s, whichever they were, both of them were right after takeoff. And you know, what it sounded like to me is the airplane was out of CG or close to out of CG, center of gravity, because they said that it was bobbling and it was pitching up and down. Well, it takes a lot of effort to make an airplane that's in CG, in center of gravity. But if you get it aft CG, they're very difficult to fly, and they are dynamically unstable. And maybe it was, I don't know, but there's a whole lot of stuff going on, and all the people I hear on television talking about it, I doubt if one of them has ever been pilot in command of a Piper Cub, much less a commercial airliner. So I don't know what the deal was there, but experience is truly the best teacher there.
Well, Professor, we've got, I don't know if we can get to it. We just did business experience trumps a college degree. This is a six-part guide, a six-part circle to successful to successfully execute a plan. There's six parts to it. Probably can't get to that, but
no, probably can't.
Did you want to try to tackle any of them?
I don't think so. Why don't we try the next one, 59? That I can do pretty quickly.
Okay.
That's
when the boss
go ahead.
All of the decisions. Managers will never learn how. When the boss makes all of the decisions, managers will never learn how.
Yeah, that when you start a business, it is difficult for the person who starts it to allow employees to make very many decisions. And the reason is twofold. First of all, it's your money. And, you were the one who put up the money, the time, the effort, came up with the idea, and now you're going to let somebody who doesn't really have a whole lot of skin in the game make decisions that might bankrupt your business or at least cause you great harm. It is tough to turn the reins loose. And there are a lot of managers, owners, managers, bosses who are very reluctant to allow anybody to make a decision. However, if you want the business to grow, you have to. And what you try to do is start with their making small decisions that are, that if they do it wrong, are not catastrophic, and work up from there. But I can remember when I first started and I had employees, I had to have employees, and I was very, very reluctant to let them make any kind of real decision because I was afraid they would do something wrong. Well, the truth is that the decision is going to be made probably by you, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make a good decision. Bosses and owners make bad decisions all the time. But they what they say to themselves is, well, if I lose $100,000 of my money, hey, I lost it. I know who the hell to blame. But if somebody else does, oh, darn, I don't like that very much. Well, you still lost $100,000, pal. And quite frankly, if you're doing it yourself, the chances of you continuing doing whatever you were doing and it's going upside down are every bit as high and maybe higher than somebody else doing it. And they're seeing that it's not going right, and they're thinking, boy, if this thing really goes upside down, I'm going to get fired, and I'll never get another job. So they go screaming for help. When you do it, who do you go screaming for help to? Yourself. Fat lot of good that's going to do. So it is very difficult to allow others to make decisions. But if you're going to grow a business past a business of two or three or four people, you have to do that. And I've had businesses where I had over 100 employees scattered over three states. And I couldn't be everywhere at once. So I'd better learn how to allow others to make decisions. And in the book, it goes through it kind of step by step of how you go about doing that. And we don't quite have time to do that because that's getting pretty well into the weeds. But it is a problem that you need to face beforehand, before it starts, and know that it's going to happen, and start letting others make decisions early on, small ones, and work up to it. And the way you do it is you allow people to actually run small areas of a business. And the guy that Walter Cable, who had an airplane airport and a big business of maintenance, big maintenance business. I mean, he had probably 25 people there. What he would do is get his employees, who were mechanics, to run portions, and then finally the whole portion of the whole mechanical repair business, the whole thing, for short periods of time, starting with probably about a week. And he would back out. The regular guy who was doing that would back out of it and turn it over to somebody else. And he'd been doing it for years, and Walter's business, if Walter wanted to go for a 2 weeks vacation, he didn't have to worry at all, because virtually every employee he had run the whole place. At least all the top ones had run the whole place, and the next level down had run parts of it, even though they weren't doing that then. They may be just a wrench turner, but they had supervised the whole thing, and that's how he trained them. And I thought it was a marvelous, marvelous method.
You know, Professor, you might, part of the reason why you might have somebody who's reluctant to turn over the reins, as you say, is because they understand that it's not the person who they would normally delegate the decision making to. They understand that it's not that person's money. You mentioned that it's that they understand that it's their own skin in the game that they have,
mm-hmm.
correct? But they, in addition to that, that thought being in the forefront of their mind, they also understand that not only is it their own money, they also realize it's not the other person's money. I mean, yes, that's
yep.
a no-brainer. Those two go two statements go hand in hand, but it's like, hey, if I know that you don't lose a dime if you make a bad decision, the worst you can do is have me fire you, you know?
Yeah.
But you can go find another job. What can happen to me? I could go bankrupt. You know
yep.
what I mean? So,
well, that's,
you know,
that's precisely it. And so they are very reluctant to do it, but you have to do it. And quite frankly, there's a bunch of really good workers that I've had who did not want to be the manager.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a few that did not want to be, and I eased them into it, and they found out they were very good at it. Just because somebody is willing to dive in and thinks that they can do it doesn't necessarily make them a success. And just because somebody thinks they can't do it does not make them a failure. I mean, it's kind of
mm-hmm.
like eating sushi. You never know what it's going to be like until you actually try it. And I had I could think of a couple of really, really good people who said, no, no, no. I want to just keep doing my little job. And I'll do my little job really well, but I don't want any of this management stuff. And so I, you know, over a period of time, get them to say, well, I'll try it for a little while. And they found that
mm-hmm.
they were really good at it. And some, after they tried it for a little while, say, not for me again. Thank you very much for the effort, but I'm never, ever, ever going to do that again. I couldn't sleep. I didn't like it. So you don't know.
So they couldn't sleep, huh?
No, they worried about every little thing. They obsessed over every little thing. And, you know, what are you assessing about? With the guy who was working next to you when he was just a wrench turner, you thought he did it. He was great. And all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
you're in charge, and the same person doing the same job, you're worried sick about it. This isn't all that good, but that's their personality, and they just wasn't cut out for it. And
yeah,
so when you want to do this,
was...
if they don't succeed, there's no blame. You watch it pretty closely. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think maybe the guy who used to be the wrench turner and now he's supervising the wrench turner understands now he's making more money as the supervisor of the wrench turner, and he understands that if this wrench turner doesn't turn that wrench properly, you might not go to the wrench turner. You might come to him, okay?
Yeah.
And so he's saying, look, you better turn that wrench right. Yeah, and I didn't say anything before
yeah.
because it wasn't my job. But, you know, you better turn it right because I'm not going to get fired because you're not turning that wrench right.
Well, not only I might go to him, I darn well will go to him because I'm not going to go over
mm-hmm.
his head and, you know, dive down to one of the person who is working under him. That's not my place. He's in charge. So absolutely.
Right.
And when Walter did it, he didn't raise their pay. I mean, you want to try this for a week? Fine. You'll get the experience, but you're not going to get paid anymore. And then you're going to go back to your old job. And that was the deal. They'd do it usually for a week, and then the most was 2 weeks that Walter did. And they didn't get paid more. They got paid the same thing. They were just doing more, but all they were doing is testing, putting their foot in the water and seeing if they think they can stand the hot or cold water and how good they are at it. And his crew was they were just fine with that. And when I first tried it, everybody was fine with it for me. Because the deal was, you're going to go back to your old job. You're just doing this as a test to see if you like it, if you can do it, and if I like the way you do it. Well, I would never really say, unless they really screwed up, oops. But you were kind of helping them along. But I wouldn't make the decision for them. I mean, I'd let them come in and talk to me. They were encouraged to come in and talk to me every day, usually in the morning or noonish. We have lunch together or sandwiches together. And in the evening, if they wanted, after the working hours, they could come in and talk to me. But when they tried to get me to make the decision, I just wouldn't do it. I said, that, you know, that's the deal. You got to make the decision. And they'd say, well, what if it's wrong? And I said, well, if I make it and it's wrong, does that make it any better? No, it still makes it wrong. So mm-hmm. I'll let you do
good
it.
Good point.
And so you know, you got to hold feet to the fire, but and as far as building a crew, that was a tremendous way of doing it.
Well, everybody, you see why I recommend this book. Again, it's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. You see why it's important to have somebody that knows what they're talking about. Because when somebody knows what they're talking about, they can give you examples. I mean, other than just a principle. You know, like some people, Professor, has noted in other shows that you have people that have written books, and they might have, you know, 10 principles or whatever, but they've never done it. And so they might be able to give you a principle, but they can't give you an example of how that principle applies to the a given situation. Well, here you've got 105 business principles. Professor, can you tell people how they can get your book?
Yeah, they can get it at Amazon. Go to the book section of Amazon and type in Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. And make sure you do the second part, because there's a bunch of books all have the same title name, but not with 105 business principles. And the other way is to go to my website, theroadtothetop.com, and you can get it there. The only difference, the price is the same. I sign the books when I sell them. Obviously, Amazon can't do that. But short of that, there you go. And in mine, you can also get the other book at my website, the other book, Finding a Career for Life. And if you want a cash flow forecast, I have a great cash flow forecast template. Only costs $15. So the Entrepreneurial Success is, I think, a little less than 18, and The Road to the Top is a little less than 10. Or the Finding a Career for Life is a little less than 10.
What a deal. You can't beat that. You can't
nope.
beat that. Well, everybody, next time Professor comes back, he'll be back on in actually 2 weeks next. Well, not 2 weeks exactly. It'll be Tuesday, okay, not Wednesday. But mark your calendars because we're going to go dig into the six-part circle to successfully execute a plan. Again, the six-part circle to successfully execute a plan. You hear people say, oh, I got a plan, I got a plan, I got a plan. Okay, well, next time Professor's on, we're going to talk about do you really have a plan, or are you just talking? Because there's six parts. There's a six-part circle to successfully execute a plan. So you want to know what those six parts are. If you can't wait, then get the book, okay, The Road to the Top. Okay, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. And Professor will sign it for you. And it's a great book. You got to get it if you're serious. I mean, that's if you're serious. Some people like to just talk about business, but if you're serious about business or you know someone who is, it would make a perfect, perfect gift for an entrepreneur. Professor, thank you so much. I know you got to run. I appreciate your time today. Always a pleasure having you. Great show.
Great show. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Talk to you later. Everybody, that's Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Again, for all of you entrepreneurs out there, all of you serious entrepreneurs, we need all the help we can get, right, when it comes to having information at our disposal that's going to help us to achieve whatever goals that we've set for ourselves, right? We need all of the aids that we can get, anything that's going to help us to achieve that goal, we need it, okay, whether it's a book, whether it's whatever the case is, somebody giving you good advice, a mentor, you know, something, we need all of the help that we can get. This book is one of the tools that can aid you in your success. There's a way to do business. Business even has its own language. You know, so let's say, for example, you decided you had a great idea for a business, and everybody who you told this idea to agreed that it was a good idea. They're like, oh, man, you could make $1 billion with that, man. What, man? You haven't put that in action yet. Okay, but then you have to ask yourself, okay, so now how do I get this out of my head and onto the paper and then off of the paper into action. There's a process to that. Okay, there are so many people that have gone to their graves with businesses, awesome business, best business ever made in their head. I mean, gone to their graves with the best business anyone could ever think of in their head. How do you get it out of your head? Well, first, it's about getting information. When you think about the people that are successful business people, I mean, just even some of them, you have successful people. All successful business people aren't known. We don't know the names of all of the successful business people. I mean, you might not have heard of Professor Geiger before you tuned into this show, okay? A successful business person. And he's written a book. He's been doing this for over 50 years. He's been an entrepreneur for over 50 years, and he has shared 105 principles, we'll call them principles, that he's learned in over 50 years of business or being in business for himself. And he's sharing this information with us. Why? So that we can benefit from his expertise. Now, the cost of the book is minor compared to what you receive from the book. One principle alone is worth more than the cost of the book. So you get the better end of this deal. If you purchase Professor Geiger's book, you get the better end of the stick, right? So he's done it. He's already done it. He's retired, okay? He's not selling this book for the money, because if he was, he would charge a lot more than what he's charging for it. So I just want to encourage you to get the book. It's one thing to tune in and listen to the shows, and that's good because he expounds on a lot of the principles. But when you have the book, you have it handy. So let's say, for example, you have to make a business decision. And you're like, man, if I could just talk to Professor Geiger. Well, when you get the book, guess what? You are talking to Professor Geiger. Or shall I say Professor Geiger is talking to you. So all you have to do is just flip through the book, find whatever principle applies to your situation, and then act on it. Okay? So, again, there's a way to do business. There's a language to business. So when you're ready to do business, I mean, because we have a lot of spiritual people that listen to this show. They might do a reading and say, okay, it's advisable for me to go into this business, but is it the right time? So once you determine that it's the right time, that it's advisable, first of all, that it's the right time, it's your cycle, there's still a way to do business. Okay, you still don't just jump out there once you find out that it's been advised, okay? God has said, yes, you should do this. God has said, yes, it's the right time to do this. You're in the right cycle. But now, you still have to do it, and there's still a way to do it, all right? You still have to know the language of business. You still have to know how business works. You still have to write a business plan, okay? And you can't have somebody else write that for you. That's something that you have to do. And there's a whole section on that in this book, all right? So, again, I encourage you to get the book. It'll be one of the best investments you've ever made in your life. I stand by that statement. And so, again, to all of you entrepreneurs out there who've started your own businesses, congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. Listen, for you to take that idea from your head, write the business plan, put it down on paper, and then now go out and execute that plan, and now this business has become like your baby, right? You've got to nourish it. You've got to feed it. You've got to water it. You've got to make sure it gets sunlight. You've got to make sure the soil that it's in is providing the minerals that it needs to help it to grow strong and healthy, right? It's your baby. It's your business. It's your baby. Congratulations. Now, you can always learn something else. Even if you think your business is thriving, you can always learn something else. And some of the things that you learned through trial and error, you can help to save somebody else the headache, the money, and the time of making those mistakes by just giving them another compass. And that's all this book is. It's another compass to help you to reach your destination safely. Okay? So, again, thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. I truly do. do appreciate you. You could be doing anything, but you've taken time out to spend an hour or so with my person and Professor Joseph T. Geiger. My name is Jawanza. Who am I? Well, I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.